This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's episode of Stand-Up Comedy, your host and MC. And this week's interview is something extra special. These days, he is known as Dr. Smirnoff, but back when I met him, he had just finished some work on the Black Sea as a Russian comic. And he's here with us today, all the way from Bali, which we got to find out why. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Yakov Smirnoff.
Yay! Oh, wow. You got a big house.
Yeah. Well, yeah. We bring out all the crowd when we have a big star like you, sir.
Oh, and I tell you, your club, in my memory, is one of the best audiences. You packed them in downtown Sacramento. You kind of, it had a low ceiling, so all the laughter was captured in there. And for a comparatively young comedian who didn't really have a lot of experience in American audiences, that was so helpful to have that kind of feedback.
Well, it was really a pleasure to not only meet you and be able to present you on the stage. And we have some great memories of working with you both on stage and off stage. But before we dive into the Laughs Unlimited years, we should let the audience listeners know that don't know you as well as I do, that before 1977, you were already a stand-up comic, but in Russia, correct?
Correct. Yes.
And yes. You were working cruise ships on the Black Sea?
That's correct. Yes. Yes. I call it the love barge. Yes.
Well, that had to be quite a bit different than working in America. Just real quick, what was it like doing comedy in a communist country?
Well, it was challenging. However, we did not know any better. So I knew that there was like a couple of comedians who were Communist Party approved comedians, and they were on the radio or on television, and they were funny, and their material, again, everything owned by the Communist Party, everything owned by the government, but the Communist Party was in charge of all the censorship of people, and comedy was one of those aspects that were, you know, they had to control, otherwise it was too dangerous because it can create an insurrection.
Yeah, there's really no such thing as free speech. In fact, you used to joke about, in reality, a Department of Jokes?
That's correct. Yeah, Minister of Culture had Department of Music, Department of Dance, Department of Humor. Oh, and humor. We had to be humor, but I call it Department of Jokes because the bureaucrats were sitting there and deciding what's going to be heard by the public. And they were bureaucrats. So they would cancel anything. Well, it sounds like I'm talking about Twitter right now. That's what they were doing. They made unilateral decisions on what was funny, what was not funny, what were people supposed to hear, what not. And so we didn't know any better. So we were coming into this deal knowing that if you want to do stand-up comedy, you will be, there was no clubs like, you know, Laughs Unlimited, or it was all government-owned theaters and, arenas, where they would put you in the government. Wow. So they want to make sure that you are approved, that you're safe. And so they censored us, every one of us. And then the informers who were in every of those venues, they were, their job was to monitor you so you don't veer off the script. And you, if you do, you know, they would punish you, whether they just fire you or cancel you or whatever it is that. And so everybody knew that, and everybody was kind of the game. Everybody knew the game.
Right.
So
right.
backstage, you and I could tell some jokes to each other if I trusted you. But otherwise, on stage, I would be very scripted to be pro-Communist Party, pro-government, pro-nothing against, no political humor.
And you couldn't do any improv or interact with the audience
No.
One of the things I don't know, and I know a lot about you because we've known each other a long, long time. Because you came to me, and even though you were still learning English and still getting your feet settled in America, how long had you done comedy before 1977?
Oh, I'm gonna kind of, age myself right there.
Then just fib. Who cares?
Okay. I started when I was 15.
Wow.
15. I left the Soviet Union when I was 26. So I was pretty established doing the pretty big venues up to like 4,000 people.
Wow.
Around the country, you know. But again, it's different there. Whatever the government wanted you to see, you don't advertise, they put you on the radio or on television, and then you become pretty well known, and then people just show up because
couldn't promote or market, right? Well,
no,
that's all fascinating, but of course, our experience together came along a bit later in 1977. Yes. You came over to the U.S., but you didn't speak any English. And you used to talk about that you kind of, didn't you kind of learn English off of television?
Yeah. And I had a good teacher, Andrew Dice Clay, who was my roommate. He was teaching me all the nursery rhymes. Yeah, absolutely. That's how I was learning English. I learned more than average person who goes to school, you know?
Yeah, but
I
the teacher's Andrew Dice Clay. That's hilarious.
Yes. So I was very, well, when you met me, it was probably 79, I'm guessing, because prior to that, I barely spoke English. So by the time I got to you, I was already doing the Comedy Store, and I was kind of getting my feet wet. But it definitely was baby steps. And you were very, very kind to let this poor immigrant on stage, and then we had some big success with that.
Oh, yeah. You were one of my great discoveries when you first came to work for me. By the way, it was in 1980, and you were, I believe you started as a featured act. I don't think you ever opened for me, but you featured a couple times, and then you were quickly a headliner because your humor, and back then, if you remember, you would do a dance and a song, and it was a big production, and people loved it. And because you were so good and grew so fast with my audience, I took advantage of that. Not only did you work all my clubs for over, two or three times a year, but I brought you in for one of our big New Year's shows. And then you did one of the concerts with Jerry Seinfeld.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah. Good old days.
So what do you remember about working with me and Try to Be Kind and Laughs Unlimited?
I will be kind. Absolutely. I was When you reached out to me and said, what are the memories? Well, the good stuff, I already mentioned, you know, that we were dealing, you know, with great crowds, and having such a responsive audience helped me grow my act and all of that. So that was very helpful. And then there was the offstage life where you had three comedians in one condo, and and we were all horny single guys most of the time, and so I had some wild stuff that probably you probably maybe didn't hear about,
but maybe better that I didn't, huh?
Better you didn't. Yeah, and so I have a good memory, some stressful, but it was definitely a production in terms of like performing at night, and then kind of during the day meeting people and saying, hey, you want to come see my show? You know, it's like, and then little by little, I was more and more confident, and I had some really good memories from dating a couple of ladies in Sacramento.
Well, yeah, that's the part I'm probably not aware of. I was going to mention that we did like taking comics that we liked, like yourself. And I know we took you bowling, and you were at, I don't know if you remember this, but I had a pool party for my son's very first birthday, and you were there. You came over for the pool party. Do you remember going to the ranch?
I do remember. Yes. I remember that.
And we didn't invite everybody, Yakov. You were special.
Oh, well, thank you. I do recall that. That was very nice. I appreciate it. And all of that, Scott, meant a lot. You know, all of that, when you are starting out in a new country and here's this American guys or American, the owner of the club, you know, kind of takes you under his wing. That's a big deal. You know, I owe a lot to you know, Mitzi Shores, you know, but and I owe a lot to a couple of other club owners. But there are very few that were personable. So when you reached out and said, "Can you spare an hour?" It's a pleasure. To talk to you.
Well, thank you. And I have to be honest, I was a pretty sharp businessman. I took advantage of your talent on several occasions. In fact, I alluded to it earlier. One of my big successes was I leased out the Sacramento Convention Center Theater, which holds about 2,200 people. And on Thanksgiving Eve, we did a packed out show, and it was you opening and then Jerry Seinfeld, and it was just amazing experience to not only be able to produce a successful concert that big, but to have two burgeoning stars like you and Jerry was just so exciting for us.
Yeah. No, I think it's great that you included me, and so good for you for seeing this into the future and grooming the talent that you have groomed.
Well, it was all my pleasure. In fact, another one I mentioned was New Year's Eve. You were amazing on one of our New Year's Eve shows. But we should move on from that because you've had quite a career. A very good friend of mine, Harry Anderson, who was one of the best comic magicians. A lot of people may recognize he was a semi-regular on Cheers, but then he had his own show, Night Court. And I know that you and he became fast friends, and he had you on his show quite a bit.
Yeah. Seven episodes. Every year they had me on, which was, again, a blessing that put me on the map. When you have such a great cast and good writers and all of that. And so I owe that as well. And Harry, it's a shame that he is no longer with us, but he was a great talent and a great friend.
Yeah, and I thought it was really, it came across in the show, but I knew because I was behind the scenes, but you guys became good friends, and he kind of looked out for you. And I think that those appearances on Night Court helped your burgeoning career. Now, did you enjoy doing TV comedy, sitcom comedy?
I did. I did. It was especially that show. Reinie Wiege was the executive producer and the head writer, and a very clever concept, very good writing. And so, yeah, I was looking forward every year to come back, and was sad when the show went off the air. But Harry and I stayed friends and saw each other. He moved to New Orleans, and we went, my wife at that time, we visited him several times. And so, yeah, it was definitely a major impact on my career, no question about it.
Yeah, and now going from live stage to sitcom comedy, was that an easy transition? Did you find acting... I remember watching the shows. You seemed like you did really well. Was it difficult?
I was lucky because first episode that I did on that show was directed by Jay Sandridge, who I became friends with after that. Now, last 35 years, we've been friends. He's 89 this month.
Wow.
And he was a brilliant director. So he made it very easy to understand the acting aspect of it and made it look very natural. And so it started me there. Prior to that, I think I did Moscow on the Hudson maybe before that.
I was about to get to that because on Night Court, one of the things I thought was made it extra comfortable for you, I think, was you were playing yourself. You were playing a Russian immigrant.
Yes, I was. That's right. That's right. Stereotype. Yes.
Yeah, and I think that helped kind of get you that transition from live entertainment into acting. But to catch the audience up, that not only did you appear on that sitcom, but you were on many talk shows, including Johnny Carson's Tonight Show.
Yeah.
Which led to, let's list the movies. Moscow on the Hudson, Brewster's Millions, one of my favorites, Buckaroo Banzai, and Money Pit. I mean, that's not a bad lineup of movies.
Yeah, and there was one more. It was with Meryl Streep and Jack Nicholson, Heartburn.
Oh.
Heartburn was also, I was in that as well.
And was were movies a lot different than TV?
It was. It was different because there was no live audience. And on TV, the live audience still gave you that element of stand-up because you could hear the immediate response to what you were doing.
Right, right. That's interesting. Sitcoms are shot before a live audience, but of course in a movie...
5 months, sometimes a year,
It's just
to see how much they filmed and how much they kept.
Oh, I bet that was interesting because they usually do several takes. Brewster's Millions was, I think, a cute movie I really enjoyed. And Moscow on the Hudson with Robin Williams is famous.
Yeah.
Buckaroo Banzai was a little bit more out there. But what was funny about that is, didn't you play the president?
It was out there. I don't even actually mention it even in my intro because it's just, it has a cult following. I didn't have a clue. You know, it was actually my first movie. It was before Moscow on the Hudson.
Oh, really?
So,
well, what was extra funny about that, if you didn't recall, but Buckaroo Banzai, what the joke was, is that the president of the United States was you, a Russian.
Well, I was not the president.
Oh.
I was Henry Kissinger, presidential, So whatever you, that was, like a
right,
Secretary
a really,
of State.
Okay, you were a really high position. And I just, that was the joke, and I thought it was funny. Yes. And but it is kind of a strange movie.
It is. I don't think I ever seen the whole movie, honestly. I get to my part, and then I go, okay, I'm done, you know, because I couldn't understand it, you know. But it was a good, it still at least gave me a start, you know.
Oh, no, it definitely did. And as we've already alluded to, you had a lot of success dropping in on sitcoms and being on talk shows. And then that led to the movies. But as all things adjust and change, and I think what was fascinating about your career, which I've followed fairly closely, was that after the television and movies, there was a shift in the country as far as comedy went, and you opened your own theater in Branson, Missouri, right?
Yes, correct.
That's a big, scary investment.
Well, it was scary. However, it was like an emergency landing, because I probably was most affected by the change. It wasn't just a shift in comedy. It was shift in the Soviet Union collapsed. And I was associated directly with the Soviet Union, even though my comedy at that point evolved and I talked about my life and my family and all of that. But as so David Letterman had a top 10 list on the night of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and the top 10 list, I was number one on that list. And
what was the joke? Yakov Smirnoff is out of a job.
Exactly. The changes that will now happen, and number one, Yakov Smirnoff will be out of work. And I was laughing. I thought, come on, you know, I'm established. I have contracts in Vegas, Atlantic City, Reno, Tahoe. What were you talking about, right? And then 6 months later, none of my contracts, none, were renewed.
No.
See, yes,
talk
sir.
About an That's- overreaction. And we should tell the audience that you were not just the quote-unquote Russian comic, but you got in really well with President Reagan, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You this and President was, Reagan stood up there and said, take down that wall.
No, kind of. Yeah, I didn't get involved. That wasn't my, but they've been very, the White House and the President Reagan liked that Soviet humor and used it a lot. So they would reach out to me when Reagan was going to Moscow for the first time. They reached out to me and they said, you know, I already at that time met the president and he liked the jokes, so they said, would you mind writing some jokes for his speech? And I'm thinking, well, if this doesn't work, I don't have any countries to go to. but I did write some jokes. They liked them. They put them in the speech. And then they said, would you mind reading the speech to see, you know, if the tone of it is correct? And I said, okay. I'm, you know, again, we're dealing with, like, how is the guy who lived in a communal apartment in the Soviet Union and came to this country now is reading a speech that the president is going to give in Moscow in front of all the politicians and Gorbachev and all of that? It just was mind blowing. But I agreed. I read the speech and I didn't think it was appropriate to, because they were kind of talking down to whoever wrote the speech.
Right.
Yeah. And I said, I think you need to change the tone. I mean, the content is fine, but I think you need to put them on equal with yourself. So that way you can you can make major progress and go a long way. Dana Rohrabacher, who was congressman later on in California, but he was head speechwriter for Ronald Reagan. So he said, "Why don't you rewrite it?" And no. I'm like, "Going, this is yes."
You didn't? Did you rewrite the speech?
Well, I rewrote just the tone of it. I didn't rewrite the whole thing. It was well written speech. It was just like, you know, saying that you need to learn how to be capitalist, you know, things like that.
Right.
And
right.
I'm like going, what are you talking about? They're totally on the opposite side. They're not gonna. So I just changed it, softened it a little bit, and they liked it, and they kept most of the changes.
Wow.
And the jokes. Yeah.
What a responsibility, though. That must have been really exciting and at the same time kind of a heavy weight.
Scary. I mean, and one of the jokes, because I was watching it, I was in Hollywood in my home, and I was watching it, a satellite broadcast, and Reagan opened with my joke, and the joke was pretty benign, pretty, you know, cute joke. It was a joke that when a child is born in Russia, an angel will come down from the skies and kiss that child. And if the child is kissed on his forehead, he's going to be ingenious. And if he's kissed on his lips, he's going to be an incredible speaker. And if he's kissed on his hand, he's going to be an outstanding artist. I don't know what place this angel kissed those your politicians that they will not give up their seat.
Did it go over with the Russians?
Well, this was my probably one of the scariest moments because no one laughed.
Oh, geez.
No one laughed. Yes. But I was so nervous, I forgot that they were waiting for the translation. None of those people spoke English at that time. And so they were waiting for the translation through those little headsets. And then it was like the longest 30 seconds probably that I experienced it. And then the crowd went crazy.
Oh, and that's funny.
I went to change my pants, you know, But that was the reality. When I look back on my career with movies and television and all of this, it's hard to imagine that this was one person's life, you know. And I'm proud of it. And very lucky as well.
Well, you earned it, though. You had a lot of talent in being invited to work on a speech. Now that means you've been to the White House a few times with Ronald Reagan. Now, my wife Jill works for the government, and we've luckily been invited to the White House a few times. But I can't imagine the White House during the Reagan years. There was so much going on.
That
must have been pretty exciting in itself.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was hearing your president telling, you know, that you're a national treasure, that, you know, I have that speech recorded it's just hard, you know, to when you put that in perspective to where I started and where I was at that time. It was hard to imagine, but it was American dream.
Yeah, what it truly was the American dream, and what an honor. Now, we kind of shifted away from Branson. How long did you have the theater in Branson, Missouri?
I still do.
Oh, you do?
I do, sir. I am probably one of the fortunate ones who can do stand-up comedy this year. Crazy. I did 100 shows this year.
Oh, man, that's amazing. And now it started off as the theater shows were based on you and your act and your life, but you went away from that, or I mean, you expanded on that and brought in some different kinds of shows, right?
Not really. All I did, it was still my show, but I, at one point, somewhere late 90s, I added, I got there in 93. So somewhere, maybe year 2000 or something, I added a Russian dance group to just kind of break up, make it more of a variety show. So I was still carrying most of it, but it had a little bit, I had a sidekick who would, we would do some sketches. So just to mix it up a little bit. And then when, then I left again, theater was still, I was renting it for like 2 years to Acrobats of China. And then the communists were still in charge. And then, And then I went to Hollywood to kind of to do what I wanted to do is to, I've been studying my attention after that whole Soviet Union collapse. I switched my attention to relationships between men and women because I figured that Cold War is not going to end ever. So I wanted job security. You know, I didn't want David Letterman to pull the plug. You know, on this.
Yeah, we're not waiting for another top 10 list. Oh, that's hilarious.
No, we're not. So that became my focus, and I got my master's degree at the University of Pennsylvania in psychology, and then proceeded, and then I went to Hollywood, did a PBS special that was named Best Show on PBS in 2016 and 17. So that gave me an opportunity to do this for a bigger audience. And then I decided to go back to Branson because it still feels like home. Now I've been there 28 years.
Wow, that's an incredible run at a theater, Yakov. Congratulations. As a guy that produced shows for off and on for the last 40 years, but consistently for 21 years, to be able to hold down and keep a theater door open for that many years.
Over 5 million people went through those doors. So and it's strong. I mean, it's still going. When I come back from Bali, I'm going to do performing arts centers. I think I have 10 around the country. And then October, November, I do 57 shows in my theater.
Wow.
So that's kind of, we
should do the math for the people. If you've had 5 million people through the doors and you're getting a dollar per person, you've made some money.
I made money. I got a divorce and I lost money.
Yeah, but wait a minute. That means the guy that's talking about relationships didn't quite make it.
That's how it started. No, that's how the whole thing started.
Was that what took you down that path?
Yes, very much so, because we moved to Branson together with my ex, and because it was, like I said, emergency landing. But then our relationship started going sour, and I think it has, finances have to do a lot with that as well. But it's kind of like a mirror of what the relationship is going through. And then shortly after, we broke up. So that's what made me go, wait a minute. My parents were married 52 years. How is that possible that I have a divorce and why? And that's what sent me on that quest when my daughter said to me, Daddy, why didn't you? I was reading her a bedtime story. And it ended with they lived happily ever after. And she looked at me with her big blue eyes. She was about 7 years old. And she said, Daddy, how come you and Mommy didn't live happily ever after? And I came up with a great answer. I said, go to sleep. And because I had no answer, right? Most people don't. And I figured, well, I'm a comedian who had my dad was an engineer. So he had that very creative, innovative mind and wanted to kind of reverse engineer everything. So I'm like going, okay, let me see. So what happened? Why is that that I didn't even see it coming? Right. And it wasn't like we were cheating or we were drinking or we were, no, we just drifted apart and I didn't see it. Yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that led to you getting a master's in psychology and then just that led you to get your master's in psychology. And then just a few years ago, you got your doctorate. So you're actually Dr. Smirnoff, and you're using that to educate and entertain audiences.
Correct. That's what the PBS special was called, Happily Ever Laughter. And you can relate to that, Scott, because you, it just happened to be that my combination of my brain cells were a little different than most maybe comedians who didn't ask that question. But if you think about this, and I asked that over 5 million people in my theater, how many of you remember laughter being part of that honeymoon stage of the relationship? And everybody remembers that, but they all applaud. And then I ask a question that is shocking to most people. I say, how many of you would go on the second date if you didn't have laughter on the first date? And silence, no one. 5 million people, it's a good sample.
Yeah, so, no, that's so true, too. I felt lucky I was able to marry my best friend, and we've been married over 20 years. We've been together over 35 years, and we still laugh almost on a daily basis. It's really heartwarming, but more than that, it's fun. You know, you only got so much time on the planet. Why not have some fun, right?
You're absolutely right, but why I went into this education route, because I wanted to do empirical studies on what are the ingredients that actually make people laugh in that early stages of their relationship. And you can compare it to your a comedy club and you can see the correlation 100%. So the formula is very simple. You meet the needs. What's important to the other person? Yeah, that's number one ingredient. And that's what you do during the honeymoon stage. And that's what you did in your club. You knew to see people close to one another because you knew that they will have more fun if they're in proximity to one another. You knew that you need to treat them kindly. And if there was raining night or whatever, and you had a sold out house, you had to do something to make them feel comfortable. You would pack them into your, hallway or your bar area to make them. So all of that we do for each other when we're in a relationship beginning. And that's what made me go, oh, wait a minute, there is a correlation. So it's meeting the needs of the other person and then using humor to trigger the laughter. And that's what you did by putting me on stage, Jerry Seinfeld on stage. You did that, but you did it by the numbers. And you didn't really know of what I'm telling you now because it was organic for you to create that for so many people.
Well, and thanks for pointing that out. And if I think about it, I would go, oh, yeah, that makes perfect sense. But I've said for a long time that I used to love putting first dates in the front row. They're close. They're a part of the show. What happens is during the show, they're sharing an experience where they're laughing. And then after the show, no matter how awkward, good or bad the date went, they have something in common to share about. And that starts a bond.
Yes, 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 yes. So that's what occurred to me. If I can use my experience of so many years of doing comedy, because I do everything the same way in my theater, I make sure that their needs are met, that what's important to my audience is there. Even during the pandemic, we had to make it safe for people with the social distancing. And then the humor would make them crack up because I said, I understand that the government requires you to walk in to the theater wearing a mask. But when you're seated, you don't need to wear a mask anymore because the virus knows when you're standing or you're sitting.
That is funny and shows how crazy our government is. Well, let's.
It is.
So I wanted to ask a couple things. First off, what are you doing in Bali? And for those of you listening, we're doing this over the phone while he's in Bali having way more fun than me.
Well, here's the reason I'm here. In Missouri, there's a snowstorm. Here is 80 degrees.
That's the reason.
You can go swimming. You know, after we finish talking, I'm going to go to the ocean and swim.
Oh,
so
that's cool.
One of the reasons. The other reason is I wanted to be more objective on being outside of America with all the stuff that's happening right now. And it does give me a lot easier. It's like, I want to see the forest, you know, from the outside, because sometimes when you're in it, it's hard to see.
Right, right. It gives you perspective.
So that's what I'm watching things on YouTube. I'm going, okay, I'm going to stay here for a little bit longer. Let them figure this out.
Well, good for you. Hey, we need to wind this up, but I did want to mention that your theater is still open and you're going to be doing some shows at the end of 2021.
October, November.
Okay, so everybody
head to Yakov.com.
Yakov.com, and it's the Yakov Smirnoff Theater in Branson, Missouri. But don't you also have some talks about relationships coming up?
I do, and that I have, again, it's all on my website on Yakov.com. I have about 10 shows, but my shows they're comedy shows that after which people walk out holding hands or hugging, because it gives them the insight on male-female relationships and how to create laughter in that.
Well, I think you have provided a great gift to this country, Yakov, from the early days of the late 70s and early 80s, and the opportunity for me personally to get to know you and work with you, to not just ever settle. You have constantly grown as an entertainer and as a person, and taken yourself through a lot of hard work through several levels, and the fact that you're still giving back, I'm just so proud that we're friends.
I'm happy that we connected, and thanks for I think you're a wonderful host. I don't say it to people, but as a podcast a host, I think you're terrific, and you're giving people also something that they probably would not get from a person who was not on the inside of comedy world.
Oh, well, thanks for saying that. Ladies and gentlemen, check out Yakov.com and be sure to visit his theater or catch one of his talks whenever you get a chance. Yakov, it has been such a joy to reconnect and talk about the old days and hear about the new days. And I'm still a little envious of you being on the beach in Bali, but thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, Scott.
All right.
Have a good day.
Everybody, stay tuned. We have some comedy entertainment live on stage from Yakov coming up right now. Thanks, Yakov.
Bye. Thanks, Scott. Bye.
That was fun. Yakov and I haven't spoken in over 30 years, and yet it felt like we just worked together last week. Man, I really enjoyed that. Hey, I was going to go to a comedy set from Yakov, but I went through the archives and I found this terrific song he did back in the mid 80s. He used to have a catchphrase, "What a country." So he did a song and it's got jokes all through it. So we're going to hear that. Here we go. Singing, it's Yakov Smirnoff.
I wanted to leave Russia, but the waiting list was long. I applied for a visa, but they gave me master charge. So I tried to escape Siberia, no matter what the cost. And finally, 2 years later, KGB tells me, get lost, get lost. So I come into America, New York was my first step. And everywhere I'm going, I'm hearing yep, yep, yep. See, yep means sex in Russia, that's really confusing. As more I keep on saying yep, the more they keep refusing.
What a country, what a country. Let's hear it for the good old USA.
In Russia, strange things going on. Forget sex, you need coupon. Thanks, America, I'm here and here I'll stay.
Yep, yep. Yeah.
I learned your language from TV with great anticipation. And 3 months later realized it was a Spanish station. TV in Russia, Channel 1 has propaganda on. And Channel 2 policeman orders you, turn back to Channel 1. My nephew is Olympic runner, TV brought him fame. They call him OJ Smirnov, screwdriver's his nickname. It's hard to be a male runner practicing all winter, cause in the summer if you lose they make you female sprinter. And it hurts.
Ouch, ouch, ouch.
What a country, what a country. Let's hear it for the good old USA. Here I relax and watch TV. Back home TV was watching me. Thanks America, I'm here and here I'll stay.
What a country.
Now, pretty as a flower. She does sexy things that Russian girl would never do, like shower. She does kinky things in bed, like wearing leather collars. And every time that we make love, it costs me $50.
Yep, yep,
yep.
What a country, what a country. Let's hear it for the good old USA.
For sex in Russia, men don't pay. Girls cannot give that stuff away. Thanks, America. And here I'll stay.
What a country, what a country. Let's hear it for the good old USA.
In Russia, certain games forbidden. The one I like, hide and stay hidden. I'm an American, and that's what I will say.
I'm out of USSR. I'm out of USSR.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.